It was a time of pride for the gay community.
I felt like I was part of a movement to liberate ourselves.
Then came a mysterious and devastating disease.
The latest figures from Los Angeles County.
We were describing evidence of a new acquired immune deficiency syndrome.
This is a story of strength and resilience.
This is our deciding moment. Together, we are greater than AIDS.
Commitment to life. Sunday, April 28th at 9 p.m. Eastern on MSNBC and streaming now on Peacock.
My status as a Black person has changed during my lifetime. My social status as a Black person. I'm not talking about did we get to full liberation. I'm not saying that at all. But the fact that I could walk into the front door of a restaurant or a hotel during this part of my life and for some decades in the past, whereas when I was born, I was not allowed to do that. And those are not like be all and end all goals for liberation. But it's very hard to get to the other bigger goals when there is a calcified, rigid system of second class citizenship.
Hello and welcome to Why Is This Happening with me, your host, Chris Hayes. Guys, huge news. I'm in another podcast closet today. Maybe you can hear a different sound of a different closet with different clothing in it. Maybe it's more vacant or maybe it's better. I don't know. I'm gonna have to find out myself when I listen to myself. But still not in the studio, though I have been going to 30 Rock for the television show. The audio studio, I think, is a bridge too far in terms of bringing in engineers for that, understandably. So here we are. My voice in our closet setup again. I'm talking to you on a day when they're doing a pretty ridiculous like propaganda exercise of the White House about American history, and amidst this like really sort of gross reactionary frenzy that has grown up around the 1619 Project, which was the New York Times Magazine special episode about slavery and its legacy. That like it's un-American, it's unpatriotic, it's damn well near seditious to view American history through the framework of a set of overlapping hierarchies and oppressions through the years that have formed the body politic, even though that's just indubitably true. Now, you know, I think there's an interesting historical debate to be had about how much that's the whole story of America. And I think there's a fascinating dialectic, one might even say, between the sort of aspirational egalitarian small d democratic ethos of all men are created equal, although of course even that is exclusionary, and the reality. And in some ways that's, I think, the engine of American history. But, you know, if you want to sort of think about all this with some rigor, there's a sense that's interesting to me about, like, on the right, that all of this is just like invented in the last few months, or like, oh, there's a 1619 Project, and now people are talking about intersectionality and, you know, all these different intersecting identities, and, you know, no one wants to talk about white men anymore. And it's just totally ahistorical. There's a long lineage of critical writing about politics in America and sort of squaring the circle of these democratic impulses with the multiplicities of identities people share and the multiplicities of forms of hierarchy and oppression that create those identities. In fact, the first time, as sort of far as we can tell, that the term, the very polarizing, much attack term, identity politics, was used, it was in a kind of manifesto that was written in 1977 by a group calling itself the Combahee River Collective Statement. And it sort of lays out a vision for a specific kind of Black feminism, leftist Black feminism, at the intersection. It doesn't use intersectionality, that would come later, but the intersection of a bunch of different identities and wrestling with a bunch of different hierarchies and oppressions that are operating in the body politic. This is an amazing document. We'll post it. You should definitely check it out. It sort of refers to a lineage through Sojourner Truth and Harriet Tubman. It's actually named after a battle that Tubman was part of in the Civil War, and of course, Ida B. Wells. And one of the authors of that is a woman named Barbara Smith, who is a legendary, category-defying figure who is a theorist and an academic, a writer, an intellectual, also an activist and an organizer, who has been alternately sort of struggling in the world of Black feminism and writing about left socialist Black feminist politics for 46 years. And I just thought at this moment, with this sort of reactionary backlash against lenses of viewing American political struggle through these different prisms, sort of coming under such sustained assault by the right, and particularly the president, it would be awesome to talk to sort of one of the legends of Black feminism and theorizing across these different identities. And so it's my great pleasure and honor to talk to Barbara Smith today. Barbara, it's great to have you.
Oh, thank you so much, Chris. I'm glad to be with you.
Did I screw that up? Did I screw up the intro in any way?
No, you did not. It was perfectly fine.
I wasn't asking my producer. I was just nervous because you are a kind of legendary. You are not a kind of. You're a legendary figure. You've had an incredible career, and I just didn't want to screw anything up. So I'm glad that I passed fact check on that.
No, you absolutely did. Let me tell you something interesting, though. We pronounced the name of the river where Harriet Tubman led that raid during the Civil War, which is in South Carolina. We always pronounce it Combahee. And I was listening to a podcast just a couple of years ago about the raid on the river. And they were interviewing people who lived in South Carolina and lived by the river. No. And every single person on that podcast pronounced it correctly because they were from South Carolina. It's actually pronounced Cumbie, like it has two syllables. And like the first vowel
like
is a U, Cumbie. So we've been pronouncing it wrong all these years, so certainly you're entitled.
That's great. Well, thank you for that correction. I hold it as a point of tremendous pride that no professional broadcaster mispronounces places more often than I do, unfortunately. It's really embarrassing. Where are you from? Where were you born?
I grew up in Cleveland, Ohio.
And you have a twin sister.
That is correct. Her name is Beverly Smith.
Yes. And you guys have been sort of co-authors and partners in crime for forever.
Oh, since the womb. Yeah, exactly. And she is one of the co-authors, one of the three co-authors of the Combahee River Collective. The other person is Demeter Frazier, another amazing Black feminist activist who's been at it for decades. So yeah, that's where we came from.
What was your childhood like in Cleveland?
What can I tell you? Well, what I always begin with is to let people know that even though I was growing up in the North, that I was born into Jim Crow. I was born in 1946, first year of the baby boom. And Jim Crow was really both the law of the land and the practice of the land. So even though my family had migrated from rural Georgia after World War I to Cleveland, even though then that we were the first children in the family to be born in the North, we were still dealing with Jim Crow, because in the North, it was de facto by in fact, as opposed to de jure, as it was in the South, which was by law. So I feel like I was one of the luckiest people on earth as far as the family that I arrived into, because they made everything that I've done in my life possible, despite the fact that we were living in a completely segregated and very, very racist and racially violent world. And education was really, really, really important. My sister Beverly says that the twin pillars in our home, and she used the term twin pillars, ironically enough, that the twin pillars were religion and education. They were just like entwined with each other. And we just, as I said, I feel like we were very fortunate, because I had big dreams when I was growing up, particularly once I read James Baldwin. And I read James Baldwin probably it was early high school, which would have been 10th grade. That's when high school started back then in Cleveland. So I read Go Tell It on the Mountain, and I thought to my little self, I said, I want to do that. And as I said, I had these big dreams, and I feel like the way that our family supported and raised us made it possible for me to achieve almost all of them.
Was Baldwin an early sort of point in your political trajectory in terms of producing or developing your political vision?
I think he certainly had an influence, but long before that was the fact that because of my age and because I grew up in the golden age of television, the first golden age of television in the early 1950s, when the civil rights movement occurred, it was broadcast on broadcast news. There were only three networks at that time. So one of the three, you know, we would be watching in the evening. And even before that, my family would listen to the radio. They were very interested in current events in general. And they, even though they didn't really explicitly say very much about what they had gone through in Georgia, in the Deep South, in the cradle, one of the cradles of the Confederacy, we kind of got it. You know, it was kind of like their attitude, their demeanor, their value system. They didn't really have to tell us about every gory detail of all the insults and all the danger that they had experienced. But as I said, somehow we got it. And then the church that our family went to, in later years when I was doing research, I found that it was considered to be the most prominent Black church in the city of Cleveland. And Cleveland was one of the 10 largest cities in the nation. So I did not know it. I was growing up in a really cosmopolitan place. And that church was very socially conscious. So every Sunday, when we got old enough to go to the church services, as opposed to staying, you know, in the nursery or where they had, you know, younger children, we would hear a message about what was going on in Alabama, in Montgomery, in Birmingham, in Albany, Georgia, whatever was going on, there would be a kind of public discussion of it through the sermons that we heard during those days. So Baldwin just kind of fit into a pattern that was already unrolling.
When do you start to engage with the sort of organized, you know, feminist movement? I mean, I know that the 1977 statement is sort of the result of kind of back and forth and some tension and frustrations with what was a kind of white dominated feminist movement in the U.S. When do you start kind of engaging with sort of feminist movements?
I really look forward to answering that. But before I do, I want to talk about being politically active in the civil rights movement as a teenager.
Please,
because
yeah.
I was. So in the mid-1960s, like many of the northern cities that had robust civil rights movements, they in Cleveland, the focus was on desegregation of the schools. And the adults who were involved in that organizing made a conscious effort to get young people involved. I was in high school during the mid-1960s. And the Cleveland public school system was building more schools because, of course, it was the baby boom. You know, there were kids everywhere you looked, you know, the largest cohort of of children and youth up until that time. And schools were bursting at the seams. So they were building several schools in Cleveland, and they districted them in such a way that they were guaranteed to be segregated, racially segregated. So, as I said, that's what I think it was the United Freedom Movement in Cleveland. That's what they were focused on. And they made a definite effort to get young people involved. And my sister and I were two of the people who got involved. So really, my activism didn't start in the women's movement. It started one Saturday in a park in Cleveland before the Monday that there was a citywide school boycott. And that was 1964. So from that day to this, I've been involved in what I think of as a struggle.
What I'm curious what you learned about just that sort of early, very early, right, you know, teenager grassroots interaction with a social movement with a very specific demand, but connected to a much larger social movement across the country and indeed the world in certain ways, like just the mechanics of struggle in terms of organizing meetings, protests, all that stuff, like what you were learning and picking up at that time.
So my sister and I, we graduated from high school in January of 1965 because Cleveland had mid-year graduations, again, because the schools were so crowded. And because we graduated in January, we got jobs. We couldn't start college until September. And we had been involved, as I said, in the civil rights movement, like going to demonstrations in front of the Board of Education, the big marble building downtown with adults. And my sister and I decided that we wanted to volunteer at the CORE office, which is the Congress of Racial Equality. And that was one of the major civil rights organizations, of course, of that time. And what was fortunate is that the executive director of CORE in Cleveland was a woman, a Black woman named Ruth Turner, who had been a high school teacher. She taught German, and she went to Oberlin College, as I recollect. And she was just the very type of smart Black woman I wanted to be when I grew up. And so when we asked her if we could volunteer at the CORE office, she said yes. And I just can't imagine that going so smoothly if there had been that kind of patriarchal leadership that would have looked at two teenage girls and they would say, I don't know what they could do. So I didn't really know about the nuts and the bolts because I don't remember going to any strategy meetings. My sister and I did office work, clerical work. We had great typing skills, filing. I learned to run a mimeograph machine at the CORE office. And so when I went to college, I went to Mount Holyoke and I got a job. Eventually, one of my campus jobs was working in the economics and sociology department, and I knew how to mimeograph. And I learned how to do that because of volunteering at CORE. But another thing that they asked us to do and allowed us to do, they were doing canvassing around housing conditions and poor housing conditions in Cleveland. So they sent my sister and me out with a wonderful man whose first name was Chuck. I'm sorry, I can't remember his last name, but I can see his face to this day. And so they sent us out to do canvassing in poor Black neighborhoods which had substandard housing. So we were doing like one of those basic kinds of activist things, which was canvassing.
Yeah, I'm curious what you learned from that. The first time you canvass is such an incredibly sort of anxiety-producing but also bracing experience, was my experience of it.
Well, I think because he was like the main person, he was a grown-up, one of the reasons that it was suggested that we go with him is that he was blind. And so we could all go together. I don't know that we were asking questions. I don't remember exactly what we did, but we were having the experience of talking with people, or at least hearing Chuck talk with people. And then we could also help Chuck get up and down stairs. And, you know, like he used a cane. He didn't have a guide dog, as I recollect. So like we were traveling with him. We were meeting people. My sister and I grew up in what I would describe as a stable working class home. But we saw that there were people who were living in much worse conditions than our family. And that was, I think, really important for me because, it gave me an understanding of like how race and class dovetail with each other, and also made me realize that I was lucky and fortunate.
So your early involvement, obviously the front lines of civil rights struggle in the 60s, this is obviously only what you're describing is, you know, what, 12 years after Brown, but of course, you know, Brown's not implemented for many, many years. One could argue that Brown's not implemented today.
Yeah, I was just going to say, and has it been implemented yet?
Right. Yeah. And then do you go off to college? Like, I guess where do you start sort of thinking in more theoretical terms about all this?
Well, these are like questions that were planted. Because, but we assure you that that is not the case. I actually studied both sociology and English in college. As I said, I went to Mount Holyoke and I designed an interdepartmental major my senior year But my junior year, I actually transferred to the New School for Social Research in New York. And they had just started a college program, a special college program, which was kind of like for all the dissident radical students who were dissatisfied with their campuses, wherever they were. They had something new, and that was at the New School. Very progressive, not to say even leftist, kind of feel to all of that, and professors. And you had to choose either a concentration in the humanities or in social science. And so since I had intended to become a sociology major, if I'd stayed at Mount Holyoke, I chose social science. And that's when I started being introduced to Hegel and Marx and Marcuse and Freud and, you know, all of them. And that was a really great background. I went back to Mount Holyoke my senior year. And as I said, I designed this interdepartmental major because I always have loved literature. And that's eventually what I ended up studying in graduate school. But my focus was actually on social theory. So, and my advisor, my sociology advisor, she had just gotten her PhD at the New School. So it was all of a piece. Like, we had kind of experienced some of the same kinds of values and other kinds of experiences having gone to the same institution. She, of course, you know, much, at a much more advanced level. So I did a lot of social theory my senior year. And then I had to figure out that I was going to go to grad school in literature, but I actually applied in sociology. But I've always felt, Chris, that background in sociology, particularly in social theory, it has stood me in very good stead.
Let's sort of talk about the Cumbie River Collective statement and the sort of moment of the sort of intersection of sort of struggles for sort of racial equity and feminist consciousness that are sort of happening at that time and produce you and your sisters writing on that.
And you had we started that a little bit earlier, and I wanted to let you know about the civil rights movement experience that I had before getting involved in the women's movement. So the women's movement was really blossoming in the late 1960s as I was graduating from college and into the early 70s. And I didn't get it. I just could not even understand, like, why do white women need a movement? They're white women. Because from our vantage point, and when I say "our," I'm not just talking about my sister and me. I'm talking about all Black women. You know, we knew what their situation was because we worked in their houses, you know, their lovely homes, cleaning and cooking and taking care of their children from time out of mind. So it was just so, like, counterintuitive to think that they needed to organize a movement because they had everything that we did not have.
That's wild. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
So. And I'm not just talking about material things. I'm talking about, like, it's just like Sojourner Truth said, like, nobody ever, you know, lifted, you know, helped me into carriages or, you know, helped me carry my load. And she said, ain't I a woman? That's basically what I was experiencing. And when I was working on my master's at the University of Pittsburgh, there were white women. There are very few Black graduate students in the English department, but there were some white women who were beginning to try to build women's studies. And I remember meeting with them. And again, it was just like, yeah, that's nice, but I'm not really about, you know, just reading more white people. and one of the things I would do in graduate school is that, like, I took a seminar in Eliot and Pound, T.S. Eliot and Ezra Pound. And, like, I thought, you know, I don't know about writing about T.S. Eliot and Ezra Pound for my final seminar paper. So I had a wonderful, cool, young professor. And I said, you know, I really would like to talk about Two Visions of the Wasteland. And I ended up writing about Gwendolyn Brooks' vision of the wasteland, which is in her work In the Mecca, and then T.S. Eliot's The Wasteland. So I was trying to find, you know, find things that I could resonate with. And as I said, both women's studies and the women's movement didn't quite click. But fortunately, there's an organization that started in the early 70s in 1973 called the National Black Feminist Organization. And that was really the catalyst for us to begin to organize as Black feminists. And also, was an organization out of which Combahee grew. So that was really my introduction. But in the meantime, I was teaching Black women writers at Emerson College in Boston. So
it's interesting to hear you talk about that, because it's a sort of theme that we return to a lot, I think, in the conversations we have on this podcast. You know, the sort of difficulty of stitching together these coalitions in center-left politics in America, left politics, liberal politics, which they require these exercises in reciprocal adoption of other people's point of view. You know what I mean? Like, and it's interesting to hear you say about sort of like encountering, understandably, this idea of like, wait, white women don't, they're, what do they need a movement for? And that the only, like, the sort of deep psychological struggle or difficulty, right, of these coalition stitching is how much of other people's experiences one has to learn about. I mean, I say this as a white straight man, to kind of like put your mind in a place where you can sort of link up arms with everyone.
And you're asking like how that was for me?
Yeah, or just like what your experience has been like watching that happen through the years that you have been on the left, right? Like that
right.
It's not like easy stuff, I guess is my point. Like it's like it's at all. And you know, it's just it just strikes me as like an eternal challenge. Like it's always going to be difficult.
It's absolutely not easy. And I think this is where identity politics comes in some ways.
Yeah.
Because, as you said, the Combahee River Collective used that term in our statement in 1977. And what we were really saying is that we have a right as Black women to build our own political agendas, and that an agenda that only addresses race from a male perspective, or an agenda that only addresses gender from a white perspective, that leaves us completely out.
Right.
It leaves us out. And a number of us were also lesbians. And so we were grappling with issues of sexuality and of homophobia as well, homophobia and heterosexism. So we really wanted to build a politics that embodied and reflected our experiences. And then, of course, because we were socialists, we had a class analysis. So we were looking at just basically race, gender, sexuality, and class. And we wanted to build a politic that would encompass all of those things. And that's really where our version of Black feminism came from. And I think that to do successful political work, whatever your identity is, we never were separatists. We worked in coalition with everybody on many different kinds of issues. But whatever your particular identity is, you do need to have just what you described, Chris, of that capacity to kind of see into somebody else's world, to see into somebody else's life, and to connect with them. And the connection, of course, is around justice.
It's interesting that when you talk about the sort of layered identities there that are present in that 77 statement, right, sort of the right to be Black feminists with a specific point of view on American politics, American struggle, and then saying also that there were, you know, lesbian members of the collective, and also then socialism. And what's striking to me is that as you list them through, it's like one of the interesting things about politics in 2020 is in some ways the ways that sort of corporate neoliberalism and capitalism, how easily they've adopted or co-opted some of those other identities, right? Like you can imagine a brand being like, you know, we support Black gay women much more than you can imagine a brand being like, we support socialism. Like it's a sort of fascinating thing that's happened, you know, when you look at from 77 to now, of the ways in which certain identities and certain claims to identity equality have entered certain spheres of discourse or been co-opted by certain parts of sort of American power structure and others have not.
Right. Well, I think that we've seen that this spring and summer with the response and the national and international response to the lynching of George Floyd. And I think that I don't know what the NASDAQ did in relationship to Black Lives Matter, but there were some incredibly improbable manifestations of support
yes.
for at least the statement of Black Lives Matter that you would just not expect. And in fact, somebody who is an incredible organizer in one of the prominent Movement for Black Lives organizations told me that they had been invited to come ring the bell, the opening bell, at the Stock Exchange. And we're just like, you gotta be kidding. Really?
That's perfect. But my favorite were the tweets that were like, here at Pop-Tarts, we want to say Black Lives Matter, you know? And you're like, whoa, Pop-Tarts is weighing in on this. I did not see
you're
that
killing
one coming. Like, that's wild. Oh, Doritos is also in the struggle. Like,
yes.
Well, what is striking is the place that you're planting your flag in this manifesto statement that's saying, like, look, we want a movement, we want a struggle that looks at through both these prisms and others, that layers all these sort of forms of analysis. Like, it's amazing to track the trajectory of American politics from that moment and what has and hasn't changed. And I'm just curious to hear how you think about it. Like, when you look back on that, planting the ground there and where we are in 2020, like, where the victories are and where they have not been.
It's interesting, because when we were talking a few minutes ago about this, topic, I was thinking about how you said that you could see, like, a brand, you know, like a national brand or international brand saying something like, we support Black gay women, but they would never say we support socialism. And what I was thinking when you said that is because they're dealing with the identities as opposed to the struggles and the system. Do you see what I'm saying? In other words, it's cute. It's now cute.
Yeah.
To
absolutely.
You know, queer and of color. And, you know, like, I mean, we see things that we would never have imagined to be the case. I mean, I know a lot of the younger activists and leaders, and like to see them in slick magazines and on the covers of magazines, it's like nobody was interested in comedy that way.
Right.
And we were just as cute as they were. We were just as cute as they were, I assure you. You know, we would have been fabulous on any of these covers of any of these magazines, but nobody was buying that. That's why we started Kitchen Table Women of Color Press, because we had to have some place to publish our work. Because mainstream publishing wasn't interested at all.
That's precisely what I mean. I mean, just like being like, hey, what's up? We are Black feminist lesbian socialists. How we doing, America? And it's like in 77, there are so many different limbs you're out on. You know what I mean? Like from centers of power and discourse.
No, we were farther than a limb. We were like out on an ice floe, you know, you know, and people were either waving at us or throwing things at us from the shore. That's how far out we were. But, we, you know, there was a lot of energy and courage coming out of the 60s. A lot of totally inspiring people to be around, like Audre Lorde, who I was friends with from the 70s until the time of her death in the early 1990s. Because we were young, we had this attitude of like, we can do this. We can make this happen. And it was just really quite energizing and phenomenal. I think, you know, that's a part of being young, of having this spirit of like, yeah, I can do that. I'm going to do that. Let's just go. Let's go. And then that's what we were trying to accomplish. You know, I think about, I have to say about Representative Ocasio-Cortez, and I think about Bernie Sanders. Because those kinds of political figures have made it much more viable to identify with socialism than democratic socialism than it was, you know, than it has ever been that I'm aware of in U.S. history. So I think we're really on the verge and tipping points and, you know, all kinds of things that are possible. The fact that all 50 states plus the territories and the colonies and all the countries around the world came out for Black Lives Matter. That's incredible. That is absolutely incredible. And we're talking about towns and villages that don't really even have any people of color in them. And yet they're standing up and saying Black Lives Matter because they saw what happened to George Floyd. And they said, you know what? Not anymore. This is not good for us. We can't do this anymore. So who knows what the future may hold. But as I said, I think people are more comfortable with the identity manifestations than they are with the content.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. And it's part of what makes navigating this political moment, I think, so complicated, such a thicket. When you have this constant impulse, I think for brands and for corporations and for capital more broadly to sort of attempt to kind of co-opt, you know, identity politics, this coinage of that statement, as essentially a kind of way of, not to sound too grad school-y here, but essentially interpolating a consumer, that like it flips this idea that like, you know, we're coming from a point of view that's produced by various forms of social of institutions, social hierarchy, oppression, and formation. And that produces a point of view. It produces a set of categories that we embody, right? And the way that as a radical left political analysis gets flipped into this is the demographic that we can market this thing to. Right. It's like two sides of the same coin.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You just mentioned the George Floyd protests and, you know, as someone who has been around activism and protests and organizing mobilization, what was your reaction to watching that?
Well, besides having my heart broken for the millionth time.
Yeah.
It's really hard to be a person of African heritage living in a place called the United States and being constantly, constantly reminded of how much contempt our lives are held in and how much we are hated. And as an elder, as some people call me, and objectively, you know, I am in the upper age group, you know, in my early 70s. But as someone who lived through all of that history, who remembers when Emmett Till was lynched, murdered, I remember that, not because I was an adult. It's because the people around, the house and my home were talking about it. And we knew something really bad and really sad had happened to a boy named Emmett Till, who was just a few years older than we were. He was about 6 years older than my sister and I. So as I said, it's a long time. And just, you know, a couple of days ago was the anniversary of the bombing of the 16th Street Baptist Church in Birmingham. That one tore me up. You know, every black woman in my generation and my age group who's politically conscious and maybe not even politically conscious, that one tore us up because we saw ourselves. How many times have we gone to church in our Sunday best, you know, giggling and laughing with our friends? How many times? But anyway, with George Floyd's egregious lynching, on video, and the cop knew that he was being filmed, and he did not care. He did not care. That's what motivated me to write the two pieces that I did this summer.
Mm-hmm.
One in the Boston Globe, titled "The Problem is White Supremacy," and then the one that came out more recently in The Nation about what to do about white supremacy. And I propose a Marshall Plan to get rid of white supremacy. So that was what I did with that. I think we don't know what the consequences of the organizing and the response. There are people who are still organizing. They haven't stopped organizing. There's people who are, you know, past 100 days of doing every single day of protest about what's going on. I think that's probably particularly true of Kentucky, Louisville, Kentucky, where Breonna Taylor's murders have not been brought to justice, despite that huge settlement that the family got a couple of days ago. So, as I said, we don't really know. I think one of the things that really bothers me, of course, and I'm sure it bothers many other people, is that we are so hampered in pushing our organizing forward during this time because of the conditions of the pandemic. It's really hard to organize something new or even to make progress in an organization that already exists when you can't get together and just kind of work it all out.
We'll be back after this quick break.
Hey, Jon Favreau here. There's no shortage of political takes in 2024, but quantity doesn't cut it. We need a better conversation about the latest biggest election of our lives. On Pod Save America, me and my co-hosts cut through the noise to help you figure out what matters and how you can help. Every Tuesday, Wednesday, and Friday, Pod Save America is breaking down the political news that makes us laugh, cry, and snap our laptops in half. Expensive year for laptops. Make sure to check out new episodes of Pod Save America on your favorite podcast platform or our YouTube channel now.
Stay up to date on the biggest issues of the day with the MSNBC Daily Newsletter. Each morning, you'll get analysis by experts you trust, video highlights from your favorite shows.
2024 is now truly the most important election in the history of our country.
Previews of our podcasts and documentaries, plus written perspectives from the newsmakers themselves, all sent directly to your inbox each morning. Get the best of MSNBC all in one place. Sign up for MSNBC Daily at MSNBC.com.
So you wrote this piece in The Nation about, and I really like the sort of ambition and boldness and sort of like concreteness of it, how to dismantle white supremacy, in which you propose, you call the Hamer-Baker plan, named after Fannie Lou Hamer and Ella Baker. Tell me what, like, you get a magic wand and you're empowered to sort of make changes at will to you know, dismantle white supremacy in the U.S. What does that look like?
That's a great question. And, you know, I puzzled over that as I was writing both articles, because I proposed or raised the possibility of, like, what would a Marshall Plan look like in the first article. And then my editor at The Nation suggested that I spin that out into another article. One of my questions is, can any government that we have that is similar to governments that we have had in the past, I'm talking about federal governments, can any government that is similar to ones that have already existed, would they even be capable of implementing such a plan? And I think it's a really, that's a very problematic question, because of the fact that in order to implement the plan, there has to be agreement that white supremacy exists.
Right.
And most people don't want to go there. They'll talk about anything else: race relations, implicit bias, microaggressions, prejudice, bigotry, anything but white supremacy. White supremacy is a system, a huge overarching system. But what it would look like to me is, like, first of all, you know, like in, you know, 12 steps, acknowledge that you have a problem. The problem is white supremacy. And then to look at every nuance and every aspect of life in our nation and get people with the best, both intellects and the best hearts to figure out, okay, how do we stop this? One of the things that I feel when I watch, you know, coverage of the unfolding, cascading hate crimes against Black bodies is, like, how much shame some people in this nation must feel as they watch it, because it's completely shameful and shame inducing to shoot a young man 7 times in the back at point blank range with his 3, 5, and 8-year-old sons in the back of his car, visible to the police officer who is doing the shooting. I mean, what is that? And as I said, there's just such great shame, you know, I think that should be engendered by all of that. But as I said, I wish somebody would give me that magic wand, because I would love to spend my time doing just exactly what the article said.
I mean, when I think about this problem, and it's part of the issue, right, of when we talk about, like, the solution, and I think a kind of nihilism that could creep in the edges. Like, when I think about climate, the climate issue is really difficult, but the solutions actually aren't. Like, we kind of actually know what they are. And the problem is an enormous political problem. But if you said, like, you get to be king of the world for a day, I could, you know, I could consult with certain people and say, like, yeah, we need to do these things. And I think we get our emissions down. It's just it's less clear with white supremacy. I mean, you know what I mean? Like, I have ideas about reforming policing. I have ideas about housing and education. But in totality, it's like, I feel sometimes the problem is so massive and so ingrained that it sometimes feels like it's out of the range of policy solutions. And I have to remind myself that that's not the case.
Well, no one ever said it was going to be easy, and no one ever said it was going to be a short trajectory. I feel like it can be solved, but there has to be the political will to make that happen. And you'll notice, like in the Nation article, I say a couple of different times in different places in the article, I don't know how we get to a consensus that this is really an appropriate and necessary thing to do, because there are people who are committed to white supremacy. And in fact, one of them I just saw on your air earlier today, William Barr, talking about how having to stay inside to protect against catching the coronavirus is tantamount to being enslaved. It's like, what? That's the first thing I heard this morning. I was just like, are you kidding? But that's what he said. He thinks that you can compare being asked to stay inside your house that you may even own, with nice Cuisinarts and Keurigs and all those kinds of things inside of it, if you are lucky enough to have that. Not all of us do. In fact, quite a few of us don't. But the thing is that he compared staying inside to protect against infection to being enslaved. So that's where we are. And whenever those people are asked, during this kind of unprecedented period that we've had since George Floyd's murder, whenever certain of those people in this administration, the current administration, are asked, do you think there is systemic oppression? Their answer is like, are you kidding? Of course not. No, there's no systemic, systemic oppression? I meant to say systemic racism. They don't even agree to like first cause, you know? So yeah, it is big, but I think we have precedents for changing things that look unchangeable. I always talk about slavery, chattel slavery in the United States, the worst version of slavery, generally agreed by scholars and historians. It's the worst version that ever existed, because you could not get out of it. You were born into it and your offspring were born into it. It was forever. And I often have said in presentations and talks, I will say, if somebody had asked in 1701, 1802, 1845, just some random dates in the 18th and 19th century, will slavery in the United States ever end? The answer would not have been no. It would have been hell no, because it didn't look like that was ever going to change. Now, what I hope is that it doesn't take a civil war, but we're hearing people talking about civil war these days, which is crazy. But yeah, we have a lot of work to do.
Do you feel, sometimes I think there's a question about like this question about American history as sort of a story of progress, a story of sort of ebbs and flows and cycles. And I think there's evidence for both. I mean, you know, the high water mark of black representation in the South was Reconstruction, when the majority of the lower house of the South Carolina state legislature was African American, and that it's almost impossible to imagine that happening again. So in some ways, there are high water marks we've hit and never have returned to, but in other ways there's obviously a tremendous amount of progress. And as someone who's sort of watching this moment unfold, when it does seem like there is progress, and particularly really interestingly, as Adam Searle wrote about, like in the public opinion of white folks, which I think is fascinating. Just your feeling about this moment, particularly compared to like these other kind of catalytic moments in the, you know, say the late 1960s when you first got involved in the civil rights movement.
I think there's similarities and differences of history does not repeat itself. Isn't that, a saying that it doesn't repeat itself, but it rhymes. I think that we have so much potential at this time if we figure out what our priorities are and how we want to utilize this time to get better and to do better. I'm always a political optimist, which is crazy given what I've seen and what I've lived through and objective circumstances. But I think there's a huge amount of passion and commitment. There's a huge amount of like just sharpness and insight and thoughtfulness. People are ready to move. We just have to figure out, those of us who consider ourselves to be organizers, we have to figure out how to connect with people in real ways around real issues that we can get that to move forward. One of the things that would really help with these projects that we're talking about, these political projects that you and I are talking about, one thing that would really help would be for working class and working poor people of all races to see each other as being in the same boat and then joining with each other to make a difference in the change. But because of white supremacy and racism, our working class has always been divided in the United States. So it's very, very complicated.
When you say you're an optimist, is that why is that? Is that disposition? Is that a praxis and will? Is that experience?
It's definitely not disposition. I'm a political optimist. I'm an optimist about struggle. So I've seen change. Like, my status as a Black person has changed during my lifetime. My social status as a Black person. I'm not talking about, did we get to full liberation? I'm not saying that at all. But the fact that I could walk into the front door of a restaurant or a hotel during this part of my life and for some decades in the past, whereas when I was born, I was not allowed to do that. And those are not like be all and end all goals for liberation. But it's very hard to get to the other bigger goals when there is a calcified, rigid system of second class citizenship.
Right.
Voter suppression is just, you know, rampant. And here we are just a few weeks before the November election, and voter suppression is out there. But voter suppression is different from no vote at all. The civil rights struggle dealt with some of the worst manifestations and the worst practices of that second class citizenship. And we've been trying to take it further ever since. And I think, you know, the movement for Black Lives and Black Lives Matter, thank goodness they exist. What would have happened during this period if there was no BLM, if there was no Black Lives Matter? How would we have understood what was going on?
Maybe I'll sort of end it here, which is, ask you to, I don't know, dispense advice. But, you know, things that you've learned over the course of your life doing this kind of work from the time you were a teenager and what you've seen. And when you watch an organization, it's not really an organization. When you watch a movement like BLM, and, you know, as you know well, right, like there's tons of beefs and fights, internal struggles, people getting cast out, people jealous or angry, people with huge debates about tactics, strategy, ideology, political associations. Like, sometimes I think it's easy to lose sight of how much all of this work involves conflict and fighting, and it's sort of endemic to it. And what you tell people who are going through that about how to sort of deal with that, deal with the fact that, you know, you're going to have conflict, there's going to be arguments over direction, and you're going to have people from the outside trying to take you down because you're challenging power. Like, how do you deal with that day in, day out, just as a human being and also as a kind of an activist and an organizer?
That's a very complicated question. I was watching an interview with Angela Davis recently, and when she was asked that question, she said, "I don't like to give advice." And I thought, yes, Angela, that's right. Don't be handing out that advice. I can't say the same thing about myself. You know, I do like to try to share things that I've experienced that I think that might be helpful. But I just really thought that's really good and that's really principled. No, don't be giving advice. Yes. So let me think about how to frame this so it's like I'm kind of doing what Angela, you know, role modeled. I think around the discouragement and the toll that it all takes, there's a wonderful article that's in one of my books, the books The book is Homegirls, a Black Feminist Anthology. It was published in 1983, and it was really the first major collection of writing by Black feminists. And the last article in the book is by Bernice Johnson Reagan, who is the founder of the wonderful a cappella Black women's singing group, Sweet Honey and the Rock. And she gave a talk at a women's music festival in California, Yosemite. And I don't know if it was late '70s or early '80s, but the name of her talk and the name of the article that I put into the book transcribed from her talk is Coalition Politics Turning the Century. And her major, she has a lot of things to say about how you get through this and deal with all the differences, et cetera, and things that you just irritate you about people to no end, no matter how much you care about them and how much you're on the same side. But she said, you have to have your home space. You have to know where your home is and know that the movement is not necessarily your home. Mm. So you go out and you struggle, and then you have some place that you go back to mm-hmm. that you can renew and rejoice and be seen for exactly who you are. And then you go out the next day and you struggle some more. People talk a lot about self-care these days, and they think that that's new. It's not really new. People in Combahee, we were doing a version of self-care back in the day, whether it was acupuncture, vegetarianism, whatever it was. We were trying to take care of ourselves, and we did. And we took care of each other emotionally as well. 12 Black women were murdered in Boston in the winter going into the spring of 1979. I said 12 Black women murdered in a four-month period. And Combahee was at the forefront of a citywide effort to deal with that horrific reality. And one of the things my sister and I decided to do, like this was May, and we had been at it since January, just trying to figure out violence against women, in the Black community. This was not a serial killer. This was several different people who all saw fit to annihilate Black women. So my sister and I decided that we would have a Mother's Day brunch because people were so just done, so drained. And so we had a Mother's Day brunch, and we borrowed waffle irons. And I think we had four different flavors of waffles. And, you know, I don't know, that might have not have been self-care because it did have a lot of carbohydrates involved.
No, that's
but
good.
The thing waffles is that are killing, yeah. We tried to figure out something. We did something yeah. to bring our community together. And we did that often and all the time. And we have to continue to do that.
Barbara Smith is a writer, theorist, author, activist. You could read her work she wrote this summer for The Nation called How to Dismantle White Supremacy. It's such a great, great pleasure to talk to you, Barbara. Thank you so much.
And thank you, Chris. I've enjoyed it equally.
Once again, my great thanks to Barbara Smith, scholar, writer, activist. You can read her piece in The Nation from over the summer. We link to on our website. We'd love to hear from you. Tweet us with the hashtag withpod, email withpod@gmail.com. Why Is This Happening is presented by MSNBC and NBC News, produced by the All In team, and features music by Eddie Cooper. You can see more of our work, including links to things we mentioned here, by going to NBCNews.com/Why Is This Happening.
It was a time of pride for the gay community.
I felt like I was part of a movement to liberate ourselves.
Then came a mysterious and devastating disease.
The latest figures from Los Angeles County.
We were describing evidence of a new acquired immune deficiency syndrome.
This is a story of strength and resilience.
This is our deciding moment. Together, we are greater than AIDS.
Commitment to life. Sunday, April 28th at 9 p.m. Eastern on MSNBC and streaming now on Peacock.